Congratulations, you have found the Lambcast, the official podcast of the Large Association of Movie Blogs, also known as the Lamb. The Lamb is the largest collective of online movie blogs and podcasts with 2,000 members and counting. Every week on the Lambcast, various members of the Lamb community get together to talk about our favorite subject, movies. So bookmark the Lamb and follow us on social media. Be sure to join us each week to hear a lively discussion of films and movie-related talk from our members. Join the flock at largeassmovieblogs.com. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Lambcast. I'm your host, Richard Kirkham, from Kirkham A Movie A Day and the Strother Martin Film Project. This week, we're taking a scenic tour of Arrakis, the exotic desert planet that is the one source of the spice melange. Now, I'm not a third-stage navigator, so we'll not be folding space to get there. Instead, we're going to be guided by the second film about the planet Dune from director Denis Villeneuve. Our guests on this tour include Nick Rehak from Lyrical Innuendo. How are things on Kaitan, Nick?
As well can be.
Excellent. You know, one observes the survivors and learns from them, and Nicole Ayers is one of the survivors that I observe from Mad Lab Post. Is the Sisterhood of the Bene Gesserit holding up this week?
They are. Here to lead the people to freedom.
Well, you know, it is said that enemies strengthen you and allies weaken you, which means that I'm going to be very weak this week. Awesome Friday podcast brings us Matthew Simpson. How do you avoid getting skin cancer under the black sun of Getty Prime?
I mean, the short answer is you don't. or that your water is full of chemicals is what it really is. It's dirty and only fit for cooling systems.
That's probably exactly why the water is so problematic. They'd have to do something to, you know, increase their SPF. Well, you know, you don't beg the sun for mercy. And for Real Movie News and Reviews, Thomas Stone Judge, is the water of life as refreshing as this week's whiskey?
Nothing is as refreshing as whiskey.
Well, most people are not creatures of reason, and once they've had a little bit of whiskey, they certainly aren't. Completing the nearly six-hour film experience of adapting Frank Herbert's iconic science fiction novel Dune, we find the House Atreides has been wiped out, Paul and his mother are tentatively taken in by the Fremen, House Harkonnen is restored to control of Arrakis, and the Emperor is self-satisfied but a bit melancholic over his plan. The original film was delayed more than a year by COVID, and Part 2 was delayed by 6 months by the trade group strikes. But it's all finally here, and we're going to find out how you feel about it. As usual, we'll start with some initial thoughts, then we'll get into some detail issues. We're going to try to avoid spoilers for the opening part of the show, but eventually... everything will be on the table. So let's start with Nicole. What's your general impression of Dune Part 2? Were you a fan of the first part, and was the second part living up to your expectations?
Yes, I was a fan of the first part, and I even enjoyed David Lynch's original version. And unfortunately, I was a bit disappointed with Part 2. I found it to be a bit underwhelming, yet still visually stunning.
Ah, so some dissension in the ranks. Somebody who is not necessarily going to be a strong advocate. Maybe you're exactly what we need, you know? We need those enemies to strengthen us. Very good. Nick, how about you? Fan, indifferent, or antagonistic?
Massive fan. I less than 24 hours after seeing it, and I can't stop thinking about it. I can't stop wanting to listen to the music of it. I immediately went on eBay and bought the books because I can't wait. Like, I need to read it and find out what happens. Like, it was best $30 I think I'm going to spend this whole year. And I was so completely blown away, and like my heart was beating fast. I couldn't breathe at times. Like, I went on an absolute roller coaster with this film, and I loved every second of it. So I'm just going to be singing praises the whole time.
Well, we have to have those counterpoints back and forth there, so we'll see whether or not other people will be singing praises or whether they'll be singing contra songs. Matthew, how about you?
So I had, I think, an interesting journey with the first film, and that the first time I saw it, I was kind of off put off by it. But then because it's Dune, I rewatched it several times and now I really like it. So I don't know if that is that it's good or that I just have Stockholm syndrome. But either way, I really enjoyed this one. And I think it's a great my initial takeaway without getting too deep into spoilers at all is that I think it's a really it's visually stunning. It's really well performed. And it's also a really great example of a movie that makes really smart adaptational choices to fit the themes that the filmmaker wants to put forward, which I'm sure we'll get into more of when we get into the spoiler section. But I thought it was really, really smartly done in addition to being just gorgeous and in every way.
Well, I don't think there's going to be a lot of doubt because his opinion has already been out there in the social internets, as they say. Thomas Dunham Judge, I suspect that you kind of like this movie.
Kind of, huh? Kind of. Let me tell you. So, I actually did not care for Dune Part One, and I don't think that it's because it's not a well-crafted film. I just Dune Part One by itself just doesn't do enough for me as a film. You know, like. In comparison to other like three-part films like Lord of the Rings, right? Like obviously The Fellowship of the Ring, it's not a complete story, but there's kind of a you know kind of a completeness to that. And I didn't get that with Dune Part One. It's so open-ended that and there's not enough that happens in Part One I have ever been too eager to go back and revisit it. And I felt the same way revisiting it right before going to see Dune Part Two. Like I don't get this. And then Dune Part 2 happens. And now I'm like, I see the pieces are coming together for me now. And I am excited for whenever it is that I can be able to watch both of these on demand back to back as like a over 5.5 hour film together as Part 1 and Part 2. Because Part 2 is stunning. It is incredible. And because you get a lot of the foundational work done in Part One, yeah, it wasn't my cup of tea by itself, but with Dune Part Two, I just love where this franchise is going, and I am a massive fan. And I originally went to a press screening a couple weeks ago and saw it and loved it. I went and saw it again opening night, and it was so cool to experience with the sold out IMAX audience that I was with. And there were times I would just like watch the audience watch the film, and it's just incredible how enamored the whole theater was with this movie. Like everyone is locked in on it, as they should be. It's amazing.
Well, I don't think there's going to be a lot of doubt on most people's part. Anybody who's been following me knows that I am a massive Dune fanatic. Nicole mentioned the David Lynch film earlier. There are several things about the David Lynch version from 1984 that I preferred to the more recent Part One of Dune. Mostly they were visual things and some technical things. The storytelling is, I think, a lot more efficient in the Villeneuve films than it was in the Lynch film, but they're affected by different things, and especially the amount of time that they could devote to telling some of these stories. As I look back at it, I can see some of the shortcuts that were being taken by Lynch to try and accomplish that sort of compacting of ideas, and let's create something here that will make what we're talking about much more visually interesting for the audience to relate to as we're going along. That's not what we get here in these stories. So we're getting a more complete telling of the story. It's one that requires some patience, although I don't think that either film feels overlong. The second film, the one that we're talking about today, I think actually flies by, and it's 10 minutes longer than Part One was, and I think it works really efficiently. Matthew has mentioned some of the storytelling that goes on in the story in the film as one of the high points of the way the movie has been adapted, and I'm going to be talking quite a bit about that when we get to those points, because I think that this movie gets some things that the book has in it that they're just hard to put into a movie unless you take time developing characters and presenting ideas in a way that the audience can relate to in a visual medium. And I think that Villeneuve managed to accomplish that with this particular film. So it sounds like most people are enthusiastic. Nicole, a bit disappointed, but not a hater. Am I correct in saying that?
Yes, you are correct.
Okay. I want to paraphrase you correctly. You know, I don't want to turn you into an antagonist. We're not going to force you to become a Harkonnen, but we do want to make sure that we're accurate in the way we present people's views here. Well, is there something in particular people wanted to start talking about? The visual image of the images of the film are probably the most dramatic thing that is easy for our listeners to get a sense of just from the advertising and the promotion of the film. So maybe we should start with that.
Yeah, you know, if I could hop in on that one, because everyone's talking about the visuals, which are absolutely stunning. But what I've been really advocating for with this movie, unsponsored, by the way, so this isn't IMAX paying me to tell people to go do this. But it truly is amazing in IMAX. I saw both of the screenings I saw in IMAX. And I mean, there's just something on top of the visuals already being amazing. There's something about that full screen framing that just makes this world feel so big. And so I wouldn't want to cut that short with the widescreen presentation of the film, if that's whatever the aspect ratio is outside of IMAX. But on top of the visuals, I think something that is overlooked, and I'm not sure if this varies from theater to theater, but something that I think is overlooked is the sound design. This movie, in the theaters that I saw it in, really had this like earth-shaking sound design that worked so well in a lot of these, you know, really big sequences. I mean, even in my review, I pointed out the scene where Paul learns to ride the sandworm. I mean, it's not combat fighting action, but it is a very high intensity scene, and the sound design on that scene was this moment for me that's just like, wow, this feels amazing. And again, that might vary from theater to theater, but that is why I've been saying go see this movie in IMAX, because it's not just visually stunning, it's really a really incredible experience.
I think that's a very good point. The sonic elements of the movie engage us a lot more. I think it pulls us in quite a bit. Most of you are probably too young to even know the reference to Sensorround, much less have been in a theater when Sensorround was used. It was a fancy stereo system that basically gave incredibly deep bass responses to things in a movie. I think they used it in two or three films back in the 1970s. They won a special award for it for the movie Earthquake. This film basically is got Sensorround kinds of auditory in it on a regular basis, but that scene that Thomas talked about where Paul is basically learning to ride the worm is, you know, it's enveloping because of the sound, not just because of the image, although I think the images are also pretty spectacular, but you feel like you have been included as part of the experience of, you know, trying to get on the worm and hold on for your dear life.
I think it's also the first time, and I'm not sure how whatever else's journey with this is, but like, as someone who's seen the 1984 movie and also the 2000 miniseries and also the 2003 Children of Doom miniseries, I would say that these movies, and this one in particular, are the first ones that make the sandworms feel as massive as the book implies they are. And a lot of that is to do with the sound that Thomas is talking about.
You know, well, I think that's, yes, definitely true, especially in the final battle sequence when the not giving too much away, but let's just say that the Emperor's Palace has arrived on Arrakis, and they know that the sandworms have arrived, and it's not by accident. It's very deliberate, and people, like you said, the massive size and scale of the sandworms is a little bit hard to visualize until you get that expansive desert, until you get the sound wall that we are dealing with. And I think the vision of Paul on top of the sandworm struggling to hold on through the sand is one of the things that makes it feel a lot different than some of those other versions where it just looks like a back screen.
Yeah, 100%. And I think that's actually honestly one of my favorite scenes. The sand ride, the worm riding scene is, I think, one of my favorite scenes in the whole movie. Just not just because of the worm riding, but because of the dialogue that immediately precedes it. I really like that teacher to student relationship between Stilgar and Paul.
Oh yeah, I think the setup on that was pretty good. Other folks have things to say either about the sound design or the way the movie looked. Nicole, you said you were a bit disappointed, but you did like the way the movie looked.
Yes, I did. I mean, I was captured by the visuals all the way. You know, kudos to the cinematographer and everyone that worked on this movie. I loved it, and just I felt like I wouldn't say that I felt like I was there, but visually, it definitely did take me for a ride, and I did appreciate the sound, although I went to an AMC that showed it in, I think, on one of their standard screens. Mm-hmm. Now I'm going to have to look for an IMAX because I already planned on watching it again for other reasons. Although I was disappointed, I do want to go see part two again because I'm still trying to wrap my head around one of the fight scenes in the movie. And, you know, after the movie was over, I said, I need to watch this again so that I can figure that out. And so since I plan to do that anyway, I'm gonna try to look for an IMAX screen to see if it gives me a different experience. But I will say the theater that I went to see it in isn't the best location to watch movies, just because of the area. And you could hear a pin drop in the theater. Talk about a captivating movie. I'm in the audience is very diverse, but the neighborhood is pretty hood. I don't know how to explain it, but if people that are familiar with gentrification, like on one side, if you go east, you might be fine. But then if you go west, you might not want to be around there after a certain time of day. And so the theater is like it attracts a melting pot of like different types of people. Yet no one spoke during this. Everyone was glued to the movie. So that's something to be said about the visuals and the sound. Kudos. So, but I do want to see this. There's a fight scene that I need to see because I don't understand how it ended.
I'm just going to ask, is it the final knife scene?
Yes, it is. Okay. Yes, it is. Yeah, okay. I'm like, wait a minute. How did that happen? Okay.
Well, we can definitely talk about that during the spoilery section,
yeah,
I think.
Yeah. Yeah. We'll come back to that. Nick, did you see it on one of those IMAX screens?
I did not. I saw it in Dolby Atmos instead.
That's acceptable, yeah.
Yeah, when it's big films like this, I go with the Atmos first because the IMAX near me still has those old ridiculous chairs, nothing like relaxing or reclining. So I want to see how the movie is first, and I'm like, all right, let me do a compare and contrast. The first time I saw Dune, saw it in Atmos. 2 days later, saw it in IMAX. They just redid the IMAX at the AMC near me, so now it's like laser IMAX or whatever. But hopefully this week, if not the next week, I'm going to try to catch an IMAX as well because I was just astounded. I was just blown away visually. The score was still outstanding. And, of course, being in the Atmos with all those different channels of sound and what have you, like that theater was rocking and it was fantastic. What I also really appreciated, and it's not like there's so much time between them, but there's still enough for some technological changes. I really like that the style pretty much stayed the same. They didn't try to do anything too fancy or introduce any new type of tech or effects work that really made it feel like a separate film. This truly does feel visually like a continuation of the first one, and I really, really appreciated that, because there's sometimes when stories, you know, take you to that next chapter, there's too much of a jump, and it just doesn't feel right. But with this, it just felt like, okay, you know, we just ended one episode of the show, now we're on to the next one. It was just, for me, it was just seamless.
Well, mm-hmm. I like your description of it as being seamless, because it does feel very much a part of the previous film. I don't think, you know, they could easily have filmed it at the same time, and it would be perfectly smooth moving from mm-hmm. one story to the other, or the second mm-hmm. part of the story. I appreciate that. I think you're right about that. On the visual elements, there were a couple of scenes that really stood out to me, and the IMAX makes a big difference. One is the arena fight that takes place on Getty Prime, which is mm-hmm. filmed primarily in black and white, and you might think is a little bit going to be indistinct because of that choice, but instead, because of the size of the screen, because of the way it's shot, it looks pretty spectacular. And the first time I saw it, I was a little hesitant about that choice, because I kept thinking, why did they do that? Why did they do that? But then the second time I saw the film, and I was watching the other scenes on Getty Prime, where there's still some muted color, but there's color in it. It's not desaturated like it is in the combat sequence in the arena. I got the feeling that it's really meant to reflect that environment on the planet with the supposed black sun that is affecting the way everything looks there. So it made sense to me, and I think it looks quite spectacular. The other thing that jumped out at me the second time I was watching the film was the Emperor's ship landing on Arrakis, and the reflection of the whole of Arrakeen on the ship, because basically the Emperor's ship is a giant mirror, and as it's landing, you're seeing, you know, the environment in which he is putting down on Dune. And I just thought that was a very interesting shot, but it also reflects, you know, how vibrantly visual this story was, and the way that the director was telling it.
Yeah, you had mentioned earlier how this was delayed from November to now, and I mean, all that I could say is the current Oscar candidates should be happy that that happened, because I think Dune would have mopped up all the technical awards. Mm-hmm. It's just so incredible what they did, what they were able to accomplish technically, both the visually, sound design, music, to set design, all of it would have, in my opinion, should have gone to Dune if it came out in November.
I can see that. I kind of had this conversation with my daughter as we were driving back from the theater. I said, well, I wasn't happy about the delay, but I am happy about the fact that Dune and Oppenheimer are not going to be canceling each other.
That's exactly what would have happened.
All right. To me, although I think the film is technically spectacular when it comes to the visuals and to the sound design, which everybody here seems to kind of agree with, I think the real accomplishment is the way the story integrates the themes of the book into something that is watchable. The big problem with the David Lynch version is that he's trying to get in a lot of those things through internal dialogues, through short visions, and sometimes through exposition that feels really awkward. I did not feel any of those problems in this particular film, and I got the impression that Matthew feels the same way about it.
Yeah, I think it made a lot of really smart choices of, 'cause, I mean, for those of you who read the book will know that it is a dense book. Like, there is just a ton of stuff on every page. And this movie makes a lot of really smart choices adaptationally, not only to serve the themes of the greater franchise, because the book itself actually kind of stands apart in terms of the story it's telling compared to the rest of the franchise thematically. But also just stuff that, like, doesn't need to be in the movie isn't in the movie. Like, in the same way that, like, the Lord of the Rings excises a number of things that aren't relevant to the plot that it's telling, this movie does the same thing. And I think to great effect, because a lot of it would just require the movie to stop and tell you a bunch of stuff, and that never happens. There are no wasted frames in this movie. It's a really great example of someone taking the source material and identifying the theme they want, the story they want to tell, and the theme they want to elucidate, and just adapting the parts correctly that need to be told.
One of the things that I liked about the film is that it really seems to be taking its time in showing the integration of Paul and Jessica into the Fremen tribes, as opposed to suddenly just turning it into a fait accompli. We see that there continues to be hesitation about accepting the Outworlders into the Fremen fold, and there is a lot of suspicion about them, and it turns out that there is justifiably some suspicion there. I do think if there is any place where it conveniently gets stuck into somebody's mouth, it's Zendaya who has to make some of those arguments a little more heavy-handedly than necessary. But I appreciate the whole theme that, in fact, the Bene Gesserit and their narrative that they're using to basically move the universe is present on Arrakis, and it is deeply entrenched into the Fremen mythologies, with the expectations of messiahs and prophecies, and most of those things probably have their roots in the Bene Gesserit plan. They don't have sides; they have plans, as they say. And I thought that was, like I said, pretty well presented. Occasionally, it just felt that the Chani is repeating herself more than necessary, but that's a very mild criticism from me. I didn't think it was annoying. I just thought, I've heard this, so why are we hearing it again? But that I thought was really an effective way of telling the story. And the other thing is that we know that Paul has hesitation because of his visions about what's going to happen, and that's the big dilemma of the story. It has always been the big dilemma of the story. Paul is not necessarily the hero of the story. He may be the failure of the universe down the road.
It's interesting when I hear fans of Dune talking about the movie, because there's a lot of context that you have brought into like your perception of what is and is supposed to happen with the movie. I haven't read the books. I've never watched the original movie. I have not seen any of those miniseries that Matt mentioned. I am like Dune virgin. And so it was
well, you waited for the right first time.
Yeah, and you know what? I would be interested in going back and seeing all the other adaptations and maybe trying to work my way through the book. But this, it was interesting being like super entirely new to this story. Maybe that really enhanced why I liked it so much, because I'm literally leaning into these plot points. And the one thing that happens after the fight. It took me by surprise are we in spoiler territory?
Let's give it a couple more minutes. Just a couple more minutes, fine. But you're on the right track.
I'll hold off. But yeah, if you know what I'm talking about, like that threw me off. And it was moments like those throughout the film where it's just like, oh, whoa, what an interesting direction to take this story, right? And so it's been kind of cool just like experiencing as it unfolds in this Denis Villeneuve version. And this being my introduction to the Dune universe, I think that really has enhanced why I like this so much. There's not a whole lot of preconceived notions of what I think should be happening, and I'm just enjoying the ride.
All right.
Me too.
Yeah.
Not as well as the ride in the worms in there. I still have some a way to go, but I too haven't read the book, nor have I seen any of the series. So my introduction with the Dune was actually part one that I watched 2 years ago, I think, on streaming, and that is, I think, one of the reasons or one of the things that made me, I guess, appreciate David Lynch's version because I've a little bit, because it helped me understand a little bit more of the different characters and that universe. When I saw part one, the person who introduced me to part one is a Dune fan, and they kind of explained some things in the first act about like who was who and whatnot. And but when I watched David Lynch's version, it gave me, besides it having better looking women, in my opinion, I do think that the story was a bit easier to understand when I watched his. And I just lost my train of thought of what I was going to say. But having seen the three films now, David Lynch's version and then part one and part two, I do like all of the Dune movies, even part two, although I was a little disappointed with it. I do think that it was executed well, and that I do think it's a great movie. I think that for me, maybe I had expectations of more action and more conflict for the character Paul. For some odd reason, when I went to see it this weekend, I felt like, not that he was given like an easy ride, but I didn't feel like he had like a huge hero's journey in the sense of like meeting big challenges or having huge obstacles to overcome. And I just wanted him to have some kind of hardship or face something that would really challenge him, I guess. And part one for me, when I saw it, I was drawn to the Duke and his quest to build an alliance with the Freemans. And although there was some disappointment in that movie, that was just based on the story and the characters. I didn't like, there was some backstabbing that happened in part one that I didn't appreciate, but I understand the motivations of that particular individual. But the overall storyline in part one, I think, was also executed well, and it felt like I was on an adventure with the characters and with the story in part one. And I didn't even see that one in a theater. I saw it on streaming a few years ago when it came out, but I didn't necessarily feel like I was on an adventure with part two. I think I wanted maybe a bit more action, or just him to struggle a little more. I don't know if I liked him, if I liked Paul in part two.
This is interesting. I don't know anything about the story or anything about the characters, right? So I'm just like watching this as it unfolds. And I don't know. I think Timothée Chalamet, we know he's a superstar, right? He's been in a number of high profile films. I think he's a good actor, and I've always recognized that. I see what Nicole is saying about wanting bigger challenges for the character. But I think maybe I overlooked that, just being so impressed that Timothée Chalamet was actually able to pull this part off so well. I think it's interesting seeing him really own this character. There's scenes, I don't know the names very well, but there's that one scene where he goes to the south and they're in the cave, and he has to be a presence in this massive room. And I just wouldn't have expected Chalamet to be able to pull that off. I think in conjunction with what we'd already talked about with the sound and with the how that scene was shot, it kind of helped enhance, what he was accomplishing in that scene. But man, he's just this like little small dude, right?
Well, it's so funny because in the first film, he's even described by Chani. She says, "You look like a little boy." And yeah. He did.
It's interesting.
And that's what he's supposed to be in that first. Yeah. The question is, can he grow into a man, the kind of man who has the sort of command that is necessary to lead a very strong culture into a war against basically the rest of the universe. And
yes,
I think that he pulls, like you said, I think he pulls it off. I thought he came across very effectively in the last half of part two as somebody who is able to make a decision, stick to their decision, know, and of course he's got the prescient vision. He knows what he has to do. It's a little bit like, you know, all those fans from the MCU. Doctor Strange knows all the paths, but he knows the one that's going to get us there.
I literally thought about Infinity War at that point. Like, there's, it's literally just like what I guess we'll just call an Infinity War moment that he has, which is great.
I'm gonna disagree with you there and say that that's a Dune moment in Infinity War, not the other way around.
Yes, there you go. There you go. That's right.
That's fair. That's fair.
it's interesting the things you guys are talking about before we get too deep into spoiler territory, but talking about Timothée Chalamet being like sort of he's a skinny guy, but one of the things I think that's hard to adapt about Dune is that Timothée Chalamet is 28 years old, 27 years old, something like that, and in the book Paul is 15. So I think if you're going to cast someone who's going to be like that physically small, Timothée Chalamet is a great choice because he is a great actor. And I think his physicality sort of fits the character, even if his actual age doesn't. And just to go back to something about that, I think Nicole said about how like you weren't sure if you were supposed to like Paul. You're not. That's just the answer. You're not supposed to like him. It's a great performance.
And
it's very, very interesting because this movie, Dune Part 2, fits the themes of Dune the series better than Dune the book does. And I think it's, again, I'm just going to go back and say it's a really interesting thematic adaptation. I really appreciate it. But he's the bad guy. Like, ultimately, he's the bad guy.
I'm trying to figure out who are the good characters, because like Rebecca Ferguson's character, she's not good. I know that. She's just this like menacing presence that I thought we were supposed to be rooting for in part one. Now I'm just, I don't know. Is Anya Taylor-Joy going to be the only good character in this series?
I liked Taylor.
I mean, I could tell you, but I think it would be a pretty big spoiler.
No, don't tell me.
but I don't know. I don't want to get into it too much until we're into like spoiler territory. But the overreaching theme of Dune the series, and I would say especially the first four books, which are the ones that I always recommend people read, like. I'm sort of fine if you don't read books 5 and 6, but 1 to 4 are all great. And the overreaching theme is that it's actually bad to get caught up in the presence and hype around a messiah type figure. It's bad. Like charismatic individuals are bad for society.
I agree.
Like heroes are bad is the theme of Dune. And I think that the part of the reason that Frank Herbert wrote Dune Messiah, which very much hammers that theme home, is because a lot of people read Dune and went, wow, Paul's a hero. And he went, wait a minute, he's not supposed to be a hero. And then he wrote Dune Messiah to be like, actually, this is what happens under Paul. I cannot wait for Dune Messiah to be adapted. I think it's going to be, I hope they just call it Dune Part 3, because that's what Dune Messiah really is. but I can't wait to see what Villeneuve does with it, because he's really driving towards that theme with this movie in particular. And I really can't wait to see what he does with the next one.
We certainly hope it has the financial success that justifies going forward with additional films in this series. I think it's probably going to result in that, because my screenings were very much busy.
And so mine too.
I think they'll be doing business. I think we'll drop the spoiler wall here so that it's clear that from now on, when we're talking, we can talk about things that are spoilers. But I wanted to drop it here, not because there was something particularly spoilery that I wanted to talk about, but there are some things that I think might cause hesitation for longtime Dune fans or questions about the film. I don't want to say that these are negatives about the film, but there are things that maybe question what was going on in the film a little bit and the choices that they made. For example, I do think that it was a deliberate choice that they make that Alia does not get born during this story. And that is, and she is in fact born in the story of Dune and does reach a level of maturity that is amazingly awkward and strange. And another one of the reasons that everybody is so fearful of both Jessica and her, because of how strange it is. And they kind of dance around that here by just keeping her in the womb, which is another thing that I think makes the movie a little bit complicated for me, because that means all of the events that we're looking at have to take place within a 9-month period, unless, you know, the Bene Gesserits have, you know, they're like sperm whales. They got a 40-month gestation period or something. That means that it's less than a year from the fall of House Atreides to the fall of the Harkonnens and the Empire. That seems to me to be, especially given how methodical they were in developing Stilgar and Paul's relationship, Chani and Paul's relationship, Jessica's integration into the position of a reverend mother, and I thought those are all good examples of how they're taking time to tell the story, and then it says no, this all happened within 9 months. That just felt a little strange to me.
I will say I thought about that in the first time I saw it, because the movie does a really great job again with scale. They don't need the subtext to say X number of years passed, right? Like, you just kind of know this takes time and there's a lot going on. And so I just assumed this is happening over the course of a number of years, because that's kind of how it's presented. These events are big and there's a lot going on. And so, yeah, this must be taking time. But then you have this pregnancy that just won't end.
I think that part of this is that, like, setting the film in a much more condensed timeline, because in the book it is like a 4-year timeline, like at the end of the finale Alia is 4, and I think that condensing the timeline, I don't necessarily disagree with what you guys are saying, but I think that, like, it's all to further the sort of religious fanaticism that takes root in the Fremen people. And it's exemplified by Stilgar through most of the film, most vehemently, but, like, it's really meant to highlight how fast and how dangerous that religious fundamentalism can take hold of me. And I think I thought it was effective in that way.
Well, I think the religious fanaticism is nicely illustrated both by Stilgar, but also by other Fremen that we encounter in the process. I like the idea that Paul kind of returns to his memory or his vision of Jamis as another kind of mentor, but unless you were paying close attention at the end of the first film, or had just recently seen the first film, you might wonder, who is this that he keeps seeing? You might forget that this is in fact the first man that he killed, that he's learned something about being a messianic figure who has to do these kinds of horrible things from the guy that he killed, and that's who's appearing in his vision giving him advice about things. And I know the story well enough. I like many of you revisited the first part the week that we were seeing the second one again. I went to the theater to see part one 2 weeks ago, and then I watched it again this week. I have too much time on my hands, apparently. I also caught up on the first of the BBC miniseries. I haven't seen Children of Dune yet, so I'm kind of interested in catching up with that one. A couple of contrasting things on those series, by the way. They do a pretty good job getting to some of the same themes in the miniseries. Unfortunately, they're doing it in the context of a television miniseries where it looks like, they said, okay, we made Flash Gordon, now we're going to make this. And it looks and it's designed very much like, a film from Dino De Laurentiis before he did Dune.
It's also very, very, like, I rewatched that a while ago, and I actually rewatched Children of Dune last night. But it's definitely made in a pre-Game of Thrones world,
Yes.
It looks, it's the kind of thing where at the time they threw a lot of money at it, but by like contemporary standards, they did not do that.
Well, they threw the money at it, but they threw it at it away so that it looks a certain way, but that's not necessarily a choice that they should have made. The costumes are ridiculous.
And the CGI is terrible.
Yeah.
The CGI is, like, even compared – I was thinking about this last night, but even compared to other things that came around out around the same time, like, say, the initial Battlestar Galactica remake miniseries, the CGI is awful.
All right. Well, does anybody else have other reservations about the film as we're getting into spoiler territory? Nick, you've been kind of quiet for a while. I didn't mean to ignore you. I just want to make sure that you are included in our discussion.
No, I'm good. When you guys get into the books and stuff, I'm not going to lie. I'm kind of half listening because I don't want to catch any, like, universal spoilers because, like I said, I just got the books and I can't wait for the other movies. Like, I have to read it to find out what happened. But no, I'm just hanging in.
Did you, out of curiosity, did you buy all six of them?
No, I didn't. I found this infographic online that was like, hey, you really only need to do the first four. And if you like the first four, then you do the other or the other two and then don't even bother with, you know, the stuff his son's doing. And I'm like, okay. So I just got those first four. So we'll see how that goes.
As a person who's read all six books and tried to read some of the Brian Herbert stuff, reading the first four is the correct choice.
Okay, cool.
All right, well, we're now past the spoiler wall, so are there things – well, Nicole, you had an issue that you wanted to talk about concerning the fight at the end of the film.
Yes, I want to know, is it Freya? Is that
Fade, right name? Fade Rautha.
Fade.
Okay, so I want to know how that fight ended up turning out the way that it did. Am I missing a knife? Because when I was watching it, I thought – like looking at the screen in the theater, I'm thinking, okay, there's a knife on my right side that I'm seeing. But then as the fight concludes, all of a sudden there's a knife on the left, I think, or something. Like, where did that one come from? And so, I just don't get it. And
I'll let Matthew explain it. He's got it ready.
I can explain this. So at the end of this fight, Fade has stabbed Paul with his knife, and as Paul, like, falls to his feet and Fade comes in with the Emperor's knife to finish Paul off, Paul pulls the knife that he's been stabbed with out of his body and stabs Fade with it. That's what
where does the knife from his shoulder come from? Because
that's the one. He grabs it with his left hand and sticks it in his gut.
Yeah. So he kills him, but then as he stands up, he still has a knife in his body that he removes.
Because he let Fade stab him a second time in order to pull the one out of him and stab him with it.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Okay, that's it right man.
There. I think
that, and it's that, kind, that,
that, by the way, it's the kind of a replay. It's kind of a replay of the combat sequence, the training sequence that happened earlier when Gurney reminds us that the battle is not all just at eye level. It's often down below where we're paying attention, and that's exactly what happens here. Paul has got Fade focused on what's happening in his eyes and face and ignoring what's happening at waist level. And that's kind of, I think, a nice follow-through on that earlier point.
I think that there's of that. And that's why I'm excited to watch them both, like, literally back to back. I really want to do just like a double feature of these two movies so that you can get that continuation and those through themes between both movies. I think the end of that fight sequence is kind of is kind of particular because it is interesting how many times Paul can get stabbed, but just one stab of the other guy is like, all
right,
kills
the monster, right?
Well, I think it's also part of that is that, like, this isn't the strongest of arguments because Fade is obviously a well-practiced killer, but I think Fade is also trying to toy with Paul a little bit and trying to, like, weaken and humiliate him, and Paul's just trying to kill Fade. Where Fade is trying to, like, make Paul look weak by stabbing him and slowing him down and wearing him down slowly, Paul is just waiting for the kill shot and takes it when he gets the opportunity. And I think that is a sort of a smart elucidation of both of their characters.
The plot point I had mentioned. Well, no, that sounds right, and I like the I like the analysis there. The plot point that I was alluding to earlier after this fight, when Paul then says, "Who does Florence Pugh play? What's her character's name?"
Aurelian.
I mean, it's
Prince Aurelian.
When he walks up, I mean, obviously he's getting on, but then he says, "I'll take her hand." He says, "I'll take her hand in marriage," and then you see the look on Zendaya's face, or on a Chani's face, when he says that. My look was of equal surprise.
And so were a couple of movie theater goers in that quiet theater that I was sitting in. In that moment, I was very surprised to hear some vocal responses in that scene from not women, but men, actually. Mm-hmm. There was a guy sitting a few seats down from me who was quiet the entire time. He was very excited about the Godzilla Kong movie trailer that played previously. But when that happened, that whole marriage thing and the scene went on Zendaya's face, he kept going,
That's what I said. I did the exact same thing. I was just like,
he kept going. So I looked over to him, and he looked at me, and I just started laughing because he kept doing it. And then I heard some people in the upper row making some comments, and like, out of the entire movie, that's the one. That's the moment.
I mean, it's such a jarring moment, because just before the fight, he explains, like, you know, I will always love you, right?
Yep.
So there's this professional love, and we're like, oh, we're rooting for you. We want you two to be together. And of course, right. I don't know how these scenes are going to play out. So we're just like, we're on the love train here. And right after the fight, he's like, oh, her. I'll take her.
Awkward.
Well, if you've been paying attention, you should have known that it was coming, because that was always the kind of objective of the original Duke, was to keep himself available for a marriage that was politically convenient and would allow him to ascend to the throne. And Paul has kind of said the same sort of thing a couple of times. Just to reassure all of you people, Princess Aurelian will not be siring any children with Paul.
Yeah. I also think, like, there's a lot of very heavy-handed is the wrong word, but, like, the Reverend Mother, Charlotte Rampling, like, heavily implies this is the goal. Like, the goal is for Irulan to be married to either Paul, whoever wins, Paul or Fade, basically. Mm-hmm. Right? And so I don't think it's a surprise in that way. And then, again, what Richard said, like, Paul is aware he needs to be able to make a politically expedient match, and marrying Irulan gives him a legitimate path to the throne.
He's screwing up the Bene Gesserit's plans.
Yeah, I mean, he's doing that from just existing.
Exactly.
I love you to Zendaya in that film, like, I thought was really smart. And a lot of one of the biggest changes in this story, sorry, Nicholas, one of the biggest changes is the way that Chani, like, reacts to Paul throughout. And I think that that's a really smart adaptational change. And I can't wait to see how that carries through to the next movie, because at the end of the book, she's aware and on board with what Paul's about and has to do to ascend the throne. So that she was shocked by it, and that the audience was shocked by it, I think is a really interesting change.
I think that it was just the delivery of it, because I think if he had proclaimed his love and then said, I will fight for her hand in marriage, it would have made sense. Like, I love you, but I got to go do this thing. But no, he says, I love you. They fight. Frey calls her his pet. Right. And so you still kind of like, OK, there's still like this attraction there, and they're still going to get together at the end of this. Right. Like, I think it was just and then after you've spent, you know, this 5-10 minute battle, whatever, thinking he's fighting for her, or thinking, like, you know, they're still a unit. It was just excellent delivery. Just like not needing to play that card so quickly. And I think that was what the surprise was for me.
Well, Zendaya's version of Chani has been given the responsibility of showing us the reservations about the religious mythology and Paul's place in it without having to have Paul go through the whole thing himself on a regular basis. And the fact that she, you know, is standoffish about that is kind of a result of, you know, just creating a character to do that in the story. I don't know how it plays out down the road. That'll be an interesting thing, because that's one of those things that I think Matthew is hinting at, that would make the next version of the film, or the next episode in the film, an interesting thing for people who are fans of the series, because that's different from mm-hmm. what happens.
And yeah, she still has a major part to play in the next part of the story too, that requires her to not have ridden off into the desert alone on a sandworm. Right. So it's an interesting choice.
I am very interested in seeing how the next part plays out, because I think that this, for me, Dune Part 2 reached a height that makes me concerned about how much better can it get. this is, I mean, just on a genre level, this is like sci-fi at its greatest right now. This is everything I want out of a sci-fi film. And, you know, I know people have criticisms about the story and about the character development and things like that. But I think that just as a theatrical sci-fi experience, like Dune Part 2 just makes it, it feels to me like a high point. And I don't know how it gets better than that. And so if it does, I might just be able to die happily.
Well, please don't do that too soon.
I think
right.
I think you might just need to be prepared for the fact that I think that you might just need to be prepared for the fact that the third movie is going to be a huge bummer.
I'm prepared for that, because, you know, at least I have Dune Part 2 and I mean Part 1 together. Like this is a solid set of sci-fi films, and I would like for the whole trilogy to be great, but I just don't know how. I don't see the way.
you need a little spice.
And water of life.
Yeah, I mean, I could talk about it more, but I think it would be unfair to Nicholas if I did. So, but
yeah, no, it's fine. We'll get there when we get there. But I mean, I think in terms of like trilogies, if that's what this is going to be, I mean, this might be the one trilogy where the second part is like the best. I'm trying to, like, I guess Terminator 2 isn't a trilogy anymore, but that may have been an example of another one where the second one's the best. But this, it's very rare to get a sequel to be the best part of a franchise, and this might be that example.
Well, there are other empires out there that would disagree, but I understand what you're talking about.
I will also.
I'm right there with you, Richard.
I will also see you and raise you a Dawn of the Planet of the Apes.
That's another good one. Yeah, that's valid.
Well, do we have other things that we want to say about the movie before we close off our discussion here? Is there something anybody wanted to draw attention to that we didn't cover? Is there an actor or a performer that you think we should take special note of? I was particularly happy to see Christopher Walken again. He's like all of us, moving on in years, and I'm glad whenever he gets a role that he's capable of accepting. And, of course, he's accepted roles over and over again over the years because he just likes to work.
It's always good to see. I will say I've kind of felt bad wanting him to be. I was hoping that he might, his character, not him, might be killed when I was in the theater. But then I felt bad because it's Christopher Walken that I wanted that I wanted the Emperor to be killed. when Paul said something like stand up or choose your champion or what have you, I thought, oh, this is the moment. He's gonna get rid of the emperor, and that didn't happen, but I didn't feel so bad. I was okay with that, because yeah, Christopher Walken, man.
And I appreciated Lea Seydoux showing up in the film for the brief parts that she was in there. And Anna Taylor-Joy is there for one 30-second scene.
That long?
Yeah. That might have been an exaggeration.
I actually would have been really annoyed with that if the Zendaya teasing and part one hadn't paid off so well. Because that was one of the reasons I really disliked part one. Oh man, Zendaya's character is gonna be a big part of the story. Oh, here she is in a vision. Here she is in a glimmer. Oh, here she is at the end. Okay, well, I guess that was Zendaya's part in this movie. But then, of course, we get to part two, and it's like, okay, here is what I've been waiting for this character. And so, I at least I have that payoff to say, okay, this little glimpse of Zendaya's or of Anya Taylor-Joy's character, there could be some really good payoff there if I'm patient.
Spoiler alert, you're going to have the same thing with Florence Pugh. She's a much bigger part to play in the next one than she did in this one.
Fantastic.
And the six-month delay that we got here was primarily so that Zendaya could wear that outfit on the black carpet, on the red carpet that everybody was talking about.
That was an outfit.
Because if they had opened the film back in November, they wouldn't have had that.
She pulled it off. It's fine. She can pull off anything.
Literally anything. She could wear paper bags and it'd be gorgeous.
She could wear paper bags and like a week later, everyone would be wearing paper bags. So it'd be fine.
I'd be wearing paper bags. Absolutely. Like I can pull it off right there.
Well, next week's episode will feature five lambs wearing paper bags. All right. Well, we're going to close off our discussion here. Wait, was there something else? I thought I heard somebody.
No, I just wanted to also.
Yes, can y'all send me the dress? Because I want to know. I don't know what you guys are referring to. Well, now I want to see the. I want to see the red carpet. Sent out your red carpet thingy.
It's spoiler. It's not a dress. It's basically a robot costume. It's great, actually. I did just want to also highlight though that like I really enjoyed Dave Bautista in these movies. I thought that. The Beast Raban is an interesting character, and I really enjoy that he seems to be really diving headfirst into capital A acting. And I think also just casting such a big, imposing dude as a character who turns out to effectively be a coward is a really smart choice. And I really enjoy where Bautista's going with his career and his acting choices.
Agreed.
And also, I'm just glad that Austin Butler didn't sound like Elvis.
No, he didn't. and I was... You know, because the character did not appear in part one, I was a little hesitant. I'm going, well, how big a part is he actually going to have? And I was pleasantly surprised that he was integrated into the story as thoroughly as he was, just enough to make him relevant and somebody that we should be interested in and concerned about if we are going to be rooting for Paul, because we certainly don't want to be rooting for Fade.
Yeah, I think bringing him in when he did was, again, another great adaptational choice. Like, he's present in the first act of the story in the book, but he didn't really have anything to do until the moment he joins the story in this telling of it. So I think that's another really smart, like, efficient adaptation.
All right. This has been our discussion of Dune Part 2. We're going to take a quick break here to hear from a couple of fellow LAM Podcasting Network shows, and then we'll be back with our exit question of the week.
Hey, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Abe.
And together, we host
Out Now with Aaron and Abe.
Hey, we pulled that off.
Hey.
This is a weekly review show, right? We talk about movies on a weekly basis.
And other things.
Yeah, we have commentary tracks, we have lots of guests.
A lot of bonus episodes, a lot of game talk, a lot of sports talk.
Yeah, some of sports talk factors in there, along with Simpsons references for whatever reason.
So give us a listen. We're everywhere podcasts are found.
Yeah, they're everywhere, right?
Everywhere.
Out Now with Aaron and Abe.
Coming live.
Sometimes?
End scene.
I think it's in there. I think I can edit that together.
Yeah. And we're back. It's time for our exit question of the week. We're on our way out of our discussion of Dune. And Dune is, of course, a science fiction film that is based on a book that is famous in science fiction circles. There have been numerous films over the years that people have tried to tackle and been successful at, and sometimes they've been less successful. And, of course, if there's any success, we're likely to get a sequel or I don't know if it's a blessing or a curse, a remake. And that's what inspired this week's exit question. What is the best remake of a science fiction film you've ever seen? And what is the worst? And I'm sure that people will have plenty of answers out there, because there are lots of things that could qualify. Matthew, let's start with you. You got a best and worst?
Definitely have I have a couple options I could say for a best, but I think the one I'm going to go with for this time is it's a remake of what is actually one of my all-time favorite movies, and that is the 2020 version of The Invisible Man. And to be clear, I love the 1933 original Invisible Man. I think it's the best of the Universal classic monster films. I think it's got a lot of great performances, and it's got really great examples of, or, you know, 1930s effects. But the updating of The Invisible Man in 2020, you know, casting it from a female perspective and really illuminating parts of our society, I thought was really, really effective. And then I also just think Lee Whannell is a great visual storyteller. Some of the fights and uses of the invisible suit in that film are truly excellent. I don't really have a good answer for the worst one, though.
Well, there's so many possibilities.
So let's go with The Day the Earth Stood Still, which is just, like, I'll go with The Day the Earth Stood Still because it's a remake of a classic and it's just kind of boring. Like, and I think boring is worse than interestingly bad. So let's do that.
Yeah, well, I think a lot of people would agree with that. Boring is not what you want. If a film is dull, and especially when you compare it to what came before, you are really shooting yourself in the foot. That's what makes it bad, not that it lacks the qualities or the goals or the performances or the technology, but that it just fails to engage. And sometimes that's what happens.
Yeah, I think that's pretty much describes the Day the Earth Stood Still remake to a T. It's not terrible. It's very competently made. Everyone seems to have bought in, but it's just boring. It's just boring, and I don't like it very much.
Thomas, you got something that you weren't bored by, and then maybe something that you were?
This is an interesting topic. I should have done more research. You know what I'll say? I'm gonna throw this out there and see if I get pushback. I think that a sci-fi film that really stuck with me, I don't know if it's the best, but one that really stuck with me was War of the Worlds with Tom Cruise, Steven Spielberg. I think that did such a really good job, at least at that point in my movie watching life, to really make an impression. And just be something that, like, I don't know, in a way even haunted me, like if aliens took over the world. I like War of the Worlds. That's one that I'll put as something else that I thought was a good remake. Bad remake. I'm looking through my tabs because there's one that I was looking at. I had a thought. Come back to me.
All right, we'll come back to you in just a second then. Nicole, it sounded like you had several possibilities.
I'm sorry.
Never mind.
I'm sorry. Really, really quick. I'm gonna throw out the all. I hate to say this. The all female version of Ghostbusters. I think that the intentions were good. But it was just too silly for me. And I know Ghostbusters is even a silly franchise, but it just wasn't the right kind of silly for me.
Well, I think there are people who argue about whether or not it's really a science fiction film. I'm going to give you credit for that. That's perfectly fine with me. And everybody, I think, who makes these movies, you know, they have the right idea. They've seen something that they want, that they liked, that they loved, that they want to say, you know, we can do this and we can add something to it and make it better or special or different enough that people will embrace it and be happy to come out and spend their money and hopefully enjoy it. And, you know, good intentions are not necessarily the result of or the outcome that you get. You sometimes just get good intentions gone bad, and I think that that's probably a good example of one.
Yeah.
Nicole,
you know, I'm gonna mildly push back on that, just to say that I don't disagree with anything you guys are saying about the 2016 Ghostbusters, but that it is still the second best Ghostbusters movie.
Well, the disdain that you have for the other two then just seems to be jumping out here. Nicole, how about you? You got something that you think we should draw our attention to, you know, a great remake of a science fiction film?
Maybe. We shall see. You are not prepared for what is to come. Before I mention my picks for best and worst, I just want to say that I am so afraid to watch The Invisible Man. And for some odd reason, when every time I hear about that movie, I think I already saw it. And then I realize, no, that was Hollow Man. I keep getting Hollow Man, Kevin Bacon's Hollow Man, mixed up with The Invisible Man. But I saw the trailer for The Invisible Man recently, and I still can't bring myself to watch the movie. It looks very scary.
It's disturbing more than scary, but you know, I think you were right from having talked to you before. It's probably not something that's in your wheelhouse.
Okay. So my criteria for this exit question for best and worst is based solely on whether I'm willing to watch a remake of a movie that I saw. And I came to this criteria because when it comes to sci-fi movies, I realized that I've only either seen the remake or the original, not both. Of course, with Dune and The Blob, I think, being the only exceptions. So for best, my pick is Death Race as the best, because as much as I like a good Sylvester Stallone movie, I just wasn't into Death Race 2000 when I saw it on DVD. But the 2008 version with Jason Statham, it looks like it might be tolerable enough to at least keep my attention. And the original Death Race didn't do that. And for the worst, I picked RoboCop, and I initially picked Total Recall as an honorable mention as well, because I believe that RoboCop and Total Recall are two movies that don't need remakes. So by default, both of their remakes were my picks for worst. That being said, while I was getting ready for this show, I knew I would probably be more likely to watch the Total Recall remake just because Colin Farrell is in it. So I considered tying it with RoboCop until I read my website. So come to find out, according to a very old post on my blog, it seems that I did indeed actually go see Total Recall, the Total Recall remake. I just don't remember seeing it, I guess, so, which probably doesn't help its case. Now, at the same time, Sony Pictures would still have to pay me today to watch RoboCop. So that's my pick for the worst remake, RoboCop. Don't mess with RoboCop, the original. Don't ruin a good thing.
I think you've got a good criteria there. And if you had to choose between the two, the one with Colin Farrell versus the one with Joel Kinnaman, Colin Farrell trumps that. So there you go. Nicholas.
Yes. I think for me, the best sci-fi remake is Dune, like plain and simple. Like I very much enjoyed the David Lynch one for sure. It's fun. It can be campy at times. And I just like David Lynch in general. So there's already a bias there. But obviously, Denis Villeneuve leaps and bounds above what Lynch was able to accomplish, given the time, given the technology, just astounding film. No questions asked. The worst sci-fi remake, in my opinion, though, is Planet of the Apes. I love the original 60s Planet of the Apes films. I think Beneath the Planet of the Apes is phenomenal and wildly underrated. I love the Matt Reeves adaptations and what he's been doing with it. I can't wait for Kingdom. Hopefully that's still happening in May. But the Tim Burton Planet of the Apes is just soulless. It's soulless. It's got so much polish on it. It's boring. Like I was so uninterested in it and so mad at it that I don't know how you can take something like Planet of the Apes and just make it kind of dull, but it managed to do that. And it's a real bummer.
You know what? I think a lot of people will probably agree with you on that one. It's not surprising. It is a bummer. And when you say it's soulless, the technology was great, the makeup stuff was terrific, but who cares? Because if you don't have, you know, something going on that you care about, all of that stuff doesn't matter very much.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, somebody's already mentioned the one that I had on my list as the worst, and that's the Total Recall remake. Total Recall is one of the great mind screws of all time when it comes to films. The Schwarzenegger film from Paul Verhoeven is just the internal structure on that and the way that the story plays out is perfect. I don't know that anybody gives a damn about what's going on in the remake. This idea of the world's being connected by this giant hole in the earth bridge, you know, I couldn't give a damn about it. I saw it one time, I barely remembered it, and I've tried to block it from my memory, so I feel good about that. Conversely, the best that came to mind immediately is one of the best, well, frankly, I think it's the best horror film ever made, and it's the best science fiction remake on the list, and that's The Thing from John Carpenter, which takes the Howard Hawks produced film from the 50s and puts it into, I mean, it takes the original story, adapts it a little more effectively. We're not just getting a monster movie where there's a giant carrot terrorizing people at the ice station, which, by the way, was pretty damn scary when I was a kid. And James Arness burning flames and being electrocuted, I was all with that. But what they do with the cast that's all isolated at the Antarctic station and the paranoia that comes up, and then of course the special effects are just like, well, it's why people love movies from the 70s and 80s, because they had practical effects in them, and you look at that and you say that looks real, despite the fact that it's something that's unreal. It looks real compared to some of the digital stuff that we see, and we go, I know that's just a digital effect, and even though it's supposed to look real, it just doesn't have the same kind of impact, and I think The Thing manages to accomplish that. Okay, folks, that's been our discussion of the new Dune Part 2. I want to thank my guests for joining me this week and give them a chance to promote anything that they would like us to turn our attention to. So, Thomas, what have you got that you want people to see or hear?
I'm kind of in between film festivals right now, so not a whole lot of content coming out. But I do have my Real Buzz series going on, a couple of reviews from films I saw at Sundance, a couple of reviews for some newer releases. I plan on doing a couple more of those episodes, part of this block for this spring. And that's kind of the thing that I've been mostly working on. You can find that and content from my other writers as well at forreal.com. Sorry, this is forreal.com. Forreal, of course, spelled F-O-R-R-E-E-L. And then, of course, connect with us on social media at This Is For Real on any platform you choose.
Nicole, what platforms are you choosing, and what do you want us to see or hear?
I'm choosing Twitter, since I'm going to be hitting the road soon to head to New York for a few days. So I'll be active on there, and I still have an entire backlog of interviews with directors and a review of a remake of Last Man Standing, I think it's called, that I have to post soon. So hopefully that will be up on my site in the next couple of weeks at themadlabpost.com, MadLabPost.com. But until then, people can find me at madlabpost on Twitter.
Nick, where can people find you?
People can find me over at rabbitholepodcasts.com. I'm on the program Lyrical Innuendo, as well as my adventure into Mystery Science Theater 3000 with Jason Soto, and that program is Play MST for Me. So head over there and check those shows out, and let us know what you think.
And Matthew, what have you got for us?
I just want to say that I think Play MST for Me is the best podcast name I've heard in a long time.
Isn't that great?
It's so good.
I'll let Soto know.
I have a weekly podcast called the Awesome Friday Podcast. We review two new films every week. Last week we did or shows. So last week we did Anyone But You and the Avatar The Last Airbender series live-action remake, which is bad. And I also write freelance for a number of places, so you can find my reviews of things like I did a written review of Avatar. I've done a written review for Exclaim, Shogun for Exclaim, the new Canadian Law and Order show for That Shelf. I do occasionally write for Thomas's website as well, although not lately. And also, I'm a member of the International Film Society Critics, and we just announced our 2023 awards this week. And you can find all of that by going to my personal homepage, which is stretched.ca.
Oh, yeah. The voting for the Movie of the Month is still going on. It's going to go on through next Sunday.
I don't want to give it away. Which one is mine, but also everyone go vote for The Last Starfighter.
I like that. It's too late. I already voted last week, I think.
On my site, it's just the usual. If I've seen something in the theater recently, there's going to be a post about it. I did get a chance to go to a special screening. I don't think it's going to open in theaters for a Amazon film, Ricky Stenicki, and... those of you who are fans of There's Something About Mary or The Hangover, look forward to having the kind of film that you enjoy available to you, apparently on Amazon, but not available to you in a theater, which is too bad because shared laughter is one of the great joys of being a human being, and it would be nice if people could see this in a theater. All right. Well, once again, I want to thank everybody, and to quote the Bene Gesserit, you know, truth suffers from too much analysis, but not on this show. Thanks, everybody.
So during this intermission, I'll tell you guys a funny part of watching the movie with an audience. So after the whole black and white fight scene, there's the one, I'm so bad with names, so you guys have to fill in the names, but where Frey is talking with that one woman who ends up having
the princess.
Yeah, the princess.
You're talking,
yeah, her,
Lea
right?
Seydoux's character, Margot Fenring.
Yes, exactly. So when she's seducing him and they're walking down the hall and she takes him to his room, it's so funny because, you know, we're all kind of like, at least the theater is like waiting for this like sex scene or whatever, and she's seducing him and he gets closer and she says, "Put your hand in the box." Yeah. And everyone in the theater goes, "Oh," and then they show the box and it's like, "Oh." There was literally two different O's that happened after she said the box and then they showed what box she's actually talking about.
That's amazing.
You've been listening to the Lambcast. If you have an idea for a show or would like to join us on the Lambcast, contact us at largeassmovieblogs.com.
I will say the one thing that was totally, like, I was all in on this movie as I am on the franchise because I think it's a great franchise, but like one of the few sort of adaptational changes I didn't like that I didn't really want to talk about during the main part of the show was right at the very end, all the ships are taking off and Rebecca Ferguson is speaking to Alia in her womb. And she's like, your brother's holy wars has begun. In my head, I immediately heard, "Begun, the Clone Wars have." Like, it's like the same shot. It's the same shot.
Find us on Facebook. Just search for Lambcast. Or on X, formerly Twitter, at Lambcast. And you can find us on YouTube as well. The Lamb site can be found at largeassmovieblogs.com. We'd also love it if you would leave a review on iTunes.
Ha 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 ha!